Welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. As you've heard, I try each episode to post some thoughts to get a conversation started about a helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality. And I want to thank those of you who have commented, questioned. I integrate your comments sometimes into episodes, definitely into the book that I'll write at the end of the project. Now, in this second section of the project, we're asking this question: does religion have anything to offer sex education? And we're in the middle of a three-part episode, Religion and Sex, A Slow Hand, An Easy Touch. This is part three. Now, in the last couple of episodes, we've been looking at the research of a noted zoologist and anthropologist, Desmond Morris. His research gives context that helps us see the ancient wisdom that has long been advocated by religion, that we better form lasting bonds when we do important psychological and emotional work before we move the relationship into erotic touch. We saw that relationships form best at a certain pace. If they form too quickly without the time and space they need to bond well, the bond becomes brittle. Dr. Morris's research extends to many cultures, many eras, many different relationship-forming norms, and he concluded that this pace, it's a human pace. It's wired into the basic evolutionary adaptations that got us here. Now, in this episode, we pick up at the fourth step. We looked at the first three last time, and again, these are not rules governing physical touch, but a roadmap that invites us to move our physical and sexual relationships forward at a pace that gives time and attention to the interior, emotional, psychological processes that are necessary to form strong bonds. Now, in this episode, the remaining nine stages move into the erotic. Our bodies now kick into the chemical motivations that we've explored earlier. But even here, there's a deep interior process that corresponds to each advancing stage of physical touch. So, Morris's fourth stage of touch, he calls hand to hand. Now, when I first held hands with a girl, it was a thrill. It was an erotic thrill. For most young people, that's about as far as our thinking goes. Wow, that's really great. But as we've been seeing, it serves us well to correlate touch with important interior processes. Holding hands starts us on a journey of intimacy. Holding hands in a sexual relationship is an external sign of a growing internal trust. It's how we signal the first stages of becoming a couple, which makes us vulnerable because it makes a social statement. It says to the onlookers in our lives, we're together. It also says we're not available right now to explore other relationships because we're exploring this one. When my kids were young, I taught them that every yes we say is a roundabout way of saying no. If you say yes to buying one car, you say no to buying another. If you say yes to watching TV in the afternoon, you say no to playing Ultimate Frisbee. Holding hands publicly crystallizes this dynamic. In that simple touch, we are saying no to other potential romantic candidates. We say, I am looking into this relationship and am not currently available to explore one with you. So holding hands does evoke a physical thrill, but it does more. It invites some internal decision-making. We ask ourselves if we're ready to say no to exploring other relationships. We ask if we're ready to acknowledge a relationship before our people, before parents or authority figures or peers or other candidates, which makes holding hands a way that we establish trust. Because we acknowledge before the world our interest in one another, which is an indirect way of saying to the other, you can trust me because I'm in this thing with you publicly. I'm telling all my people that I'm exploring this thing with you. Now, no kid ever thinks these kind of thoughts. Very few adults would even think to talk to young people this way. But there are important relationship-building dynamics built right into this process. And it is helpful if we move these processes from the tacit, unspoken, and unthought into explicit, considered, and overt awareness. Because hand-holding is laden with more than just a physical thrill. And because it is, we kind of know that because we start off so tentatively. Think about the way that you first held hands. It often begins with a test run. Maybe we would jokingly shake hands with one another or take the other's hand as a guise, under the guise of helping one another over a step. Because part of us knows the internal questions that are at stake. But we can help our young people by explicitly naming these interior processings. Trust is scary. Limiting our options for other candidates by publicly acknowledging this one, that's scary. So it's good to name the scary things and to address them up front, to acknowledge the risk that's involved, the gamble, and then decide explicitly rather than falling into them tacitly. Better to frame the questions directly. Am I ready for this risk? What if I extend my hand and he or she doesn't reciprocate? What if I want to publicly acknowledge this relationship, but he or she doesn't? Again, that's a lot of interior stuff wrapped up in the simple act of holding hands. Inner stuff that takes time. It takes readiness. It takes time to assess the risks, time to decide if we're going to limit our options. It takes time to commit ourselves to even an exploratory process, which is, again, time that couples rarely give themselves. If we take this time, only a little bit happens with our bodies, but some really important stuff has transpired inside. Sustainable relationship stuff, head and heart stuff. This is work that lays a foundation for potential relational longevity. Now, Morris's next stage, the fifth stage, is arm to shoulder. When we put our arms around another's shoulders, while we still allow one another a bit of distance, we are drawing closer than we were when we were holding hands. And the erotic thrill that hand-holding once created slows down, but when arm goes to shoulder, that thrill returns. Again, there is physical touch involved, there is erotic touch involved, but here too, there is a corresponding psycho-emotional process inside. Arms to shoulder, again, moving the relationship forward, indicates an ownership stake in the relationship. Public hand-holding stated, we are exploring a special relationship. Arm to shoulder says, we are in a special relationship. It says, both of us agree, this is going somewhere. Our bodies indicate a deep relational commitment. We say with our touch, I'm ready and I'm in. Let's move this thing forward. Hearts and minds are at work, work that takes time, but again, not much has happened in the pants. But what has happened is important. Preparing ourselves to say, I'm in, and then letting one another know, I'm ready to do what needs to be done, this lays important groundwork for a stable bond. Going forward from here, a healthy relationship makes significantly stiffer demands on the couple, demands that will require two people who are all in. It will require two people who do share the sense of responsibility for the relationship. That's an important processing that happens in that stage. In the sixth stage, Morris calls it arm to waist. This too is erotic. Hands are closer to the genitals than they were, and our bodies realize this, and the thrill is even deeper. This posture indicates growing familiarity and comfort and trust, which comes with its own interior psychological emotional stuff. We know what the posture looks like. You see it on the beach all the time. A couple's bodies are side by side, heads are inclined to each other, their faces forward, their heads are usually pointed toward the ground. And they're talking, but they're projecting their voices toward the ground. That's what we do when we first start revealing ourselves. Our body posture indicates what our hearts are doing. I'm not ready to look you in the face, our body is saying, as I tell you my secrets, but I am ready to start telling you my secrets. I'll just look at the ground for a bit. I'll tell you some things, and then we'll see how it goes. So we venture out. We disclose things that we don't tell other people. We begin to make ourselves vulnerable in a way that we don't with other people. The relationship becomes special. We disclose and we discuss and we evaluate the deep things in our lives. We hear what is important to one another, about the things that we believe and hope for and dream and want. We talk about our dreams. Dreams we don't tell other people, things we hold in the secret places of our hearts. And we watch. We watch what the other person does with our vulnerability. What do you do when I share my secret? Do you laugh or do you dismiss or do you diminish or do you honor my secrets? Are you as hungry to know me as I am hungry to know you? We tell secrets and we assess one another as potential confidants. I will have other secrets in my lifetime. Can I spend that lifetime sharing them with you? We're assessing one another's suitability as a confidant. Pair bonds with staying power do that. They act as lifelong confidants. And during Arm to Waste, we set the relationship on this path. We tell our secrets and we assess trustworthiness. We assess how highly we rank the other's priorities and how highly the other ranks ours. This is a critical stage in the bonding process, which takes time and energy, significant time and energy. We disclose, and then we go home and process what we disclosed. Apart from one another, we determine what we want to disclose next time, and then we ready ourselves to do it. And we ask ourselves, what are my values? What are my beliefs? What are my dreams that I want to share? Moving the sexual journey forward without making these kinds of honest assessments, that's an invitation to future pain. After this stage, the erotic chemicals will do what they are designed to do. They will knit our hearts deeply to one another. They will push us toward commitment and loyalty. And once there, if we separate from one another, it cuts deeply. It leaves deep, painful wounds. And so, at this stage, the secret sharing stage, we are making really important decisions. Shall this relationship proceed or not? If doubts or questions exist, now is the time. It'll be hard to have the difficult conversation about breaking it off now, but it'll never be easier than it is at this stage. This is the time to say, you're a wonderful person. Like me, you deserve to be with someone who's a perfect fit for you. I don't think we're a perfect fit. We can have that conversation. It'll be difficult, but we can do it now. Because if we don't have the trust, we haven't been disclosing and we haven't been disclosed to, it's an invitation to future pain. Now notice what hasn't happened yet. There hasn't been heavy kissing. There's been no breast fondling, no genital stimulation through the clothing, no oral sex, no orgasms. But significant internal processing has happened. Processing that turns out to be really important for establishing a bond that lasts. Now again, this is not how we do sexuality as a culture. Could you imagine yourself front-loading all that non-erotic work when you were 16? Front-loading all that work, that's just out of sync with the times. However, it is here that the danger of having moved the physical relationship forward without these processes really shows up, because if we skip these stages or if we rush them, their absence will hurt us as we move forward from here. If we haven't done the work of these earlier stages, relationships become top-heavy. They become overly dependent on an unsustainable physical thrill, which makes relationships fragile. Which again is why a viable sex education is so important. It's why young people need sensible elders to teach them about their bodies and their souls and their minds and their hearts and how things work. Now Morris's remaining stages focus on vulnerability and trust. If we decide to continue the relationship and move it forward, the next stage is kissing, what Morris calls face-to-face. Kissing is very arousing sexually, but it's also deeply vulnerable. At this point, we shift from spoken communication to nonverbal communication. We spend more time gazing into one another's eyes. We look into the deep parts of one another's hearts. We begin what the ancient biblical language called knowing. For a couple to be sexually active was to know one another. In face-to-face, we grant a very intense form of access that begins this kind of knowing. Because looking deeply into another person's eyes does that. You know how we tend to turn away from direct eye contact if it lasts too long in a normal setting, but if we allow that access, our eyes grant access to our hearts. So we hug, and we kiss deeply, and we have long periods of sustained eye contact, which of course evokes strong erotic arousal, but it also creates a deep sense of connectedness. We've told one another our secrets. We have prepared psychologically and emotionally for this intense intimacy. So, as verbal communication begins to take a back seat, we focus on learning one another's facial cues, which moves couples very quickly to Morris's eighth stage, hand to face. As we kiss, we run our hands through one another's hair. We cradle one another's faces, which reinforces and deepens trust for one another. We only allow those we most trust to touch us like that. Parents and intimate family members can touch our heads. Priests are sometimes allowed to touch our heads, but even those people are typically limited to touching our forehead or the top of our head. Touching another person's face, this is reserved for the most intimate of relationships, which makes face touch really important. It's a way we signal the deepest levels of trust. When our partner allows us to touch his or her face, when we allow our partner to touch ours and neither of us pulls away, in a very deep way, we are saying, I trust you. Now, trust is the traveling companion of vulnerability. And the deepest trust invites the deepest vulnerability. So to be ready for this kind of touch, this kind of trust, requires time and space, time for internal readiness, time to prepare ourselves to say, I am here to love you and I will not hurt you. You can trust me. And time to assess the trustworthiness of that same message coming from our partner. Now, this just can't be hurried. We ready ourselves for this degree of trust over time. We earn this kind of trust over time. Time and space is required to be able to grant this kind of trust and to be able to authentically receive this kind of trust. And so Morris's ninth physical stage is hand to body. We begin to explore one another's bodies, outside clothing at first, but then inside, but not yet the genitals. This is deep caressing, which is both arousing and erotic and also indicative of a deep abiding love. Our hearts and our minds come to a full commitment to one another. I am giving myself to you, and I am receiving you myself. And as we gain an intimate understanding of one another's bodies, we develop deep appreciation and respect for one another. We know, and we learn to savor one another's height and weight and hair pattern and complexion. We begin to experience one another as real beings that come in a real body that has perfect places and has imperfect places. We know and touch the glorious parts and the flawed parts, and every part is noted and accepted and loved. Now, in our society, this stage touches on a collective social illness. We tend to carry, as a culture, an unhealthy focus on body images. We have inherited impossible physical standards from the media, and so this kind of intimate and accepting and embracing touch, it takes time and it makes us vulnerable and it requires a deepened trust. Again, time we don't usually give these stages. So Morris's final stages are mouth to breast, hand to genital, and genital to genital. This last triad is the deepest expression of physical intimacy that human beings can experience. Oral and anal sex are simply iterations of these, which means there are no stages after this. As such, they are our best hope of inviting and extending a total giving of ourselves to another. These are stages of total trust and total commitment. They speak of unconditional sharing of ourselves with another. They speak of a human connection that is so deep that it evokes an unspoken expectation of permanency. It's this interior expectation of permanency that we articulate in the traditional wedding vows. For better or worse, we say, we'll be here through rich times and poor times, in sickness and in health. I will be here with you permanently in good times and bad. We speak of a total giving of ourselves to another, which speaks of trust and commitment that runs so deeply in our souls that if permanency and unconditionality is not part of the relationship, this kind of touch actually defrauds a deep place in one another's hearts. These final stages of physical touch form the highest hope for human intimacy when there are no further stages to which we can appeal. That deep longing for connection that we all carry, this is it. So, if we touch this way, but we have not done the internal work required for deep intimacy, if we touch this way without putting in the necessary psychological and emotional and relational work, if we haven't put those elements in place in the earlier stages, then our touch makes a promise to ourselves and to our partners. But it's a promise that we cannot keep. If we don't put the processes in place, then this kind of touch invites an expectation that cannot be fulfilled. And consequently, it invites heartache and disappointment that cannot but jade us. So those are the stages of physical touch, psychological and emotional processes that go into relationship building that will form bonds that can potentially have resilience, longevity, and strength. His was an academic approach, but his conclusions echo the ancient wisdom of religion. Sexual touch without appropriate levels of commitment, sexual touch without requisite internal processing, pretends to give a gift that it cannot really give, and asks for a gift that cannot really be given. The pacing Morris's studies suggest works because it gives our whole being the time it needs to form durable bonds. And it is a pacing that religious wisdom has advocated for generations. Without the academic studies to back it up, religion figured out some time ago that there is a pacing that creates stable, lasting, strong bonds. That there are psychological and physical and emotional steps that work in tandem with one another, that when given the time and the processing they require, will allow human beings to form bonds that can last a lifetime. Now, as we said before we looked at Dr. Morris's work, today's cultural norms aren't even close to this pacing. In fact, our culture would resist a sexual temple like this. And interestingly, a big part of the reason for that resistance is that it has been the pacing advocated by religion. And as we've seen, religion has lost its voice. Reacting against religion's rule-driven, God says, dirty sex instincts, the cultural pendulum has swung toward sexual norms that act as though sex can be casual or that sex can be neutral. And acting on this assumption, we all get into bed after just a few dates, all of us thinking that's a harmless way to enjoy one another. And religion, unfortunately, has cried wolf so long, saying something like sex is bad or sex will hurt you or the other things that we've seen in this podcast. People are no longer listening. But it's bad and it will hurt you. That is not really religion's wisdom. What religion's wisdom is this. Our sexuality is bigger and more vast and more expansive than we realize. And no, it's not bad. And no, it doesn't hurt us. It is a really important part of being human. And it can lead us into the deepest experiences of life and love. But what an inappropriate pacing does do is work against the process of sexuality's full fulfillment in our lives. What an inappropriate pacing does do is it works against the process by moving too quickly, not giving it the time that it needs, and it can hurt us. Casual sex is like empty white bread or white sugar calories. They're not bad, they just aren't rich in the nutrients we need. And couple after couple, person after person, practice sexuality without the nutrient-dense mind work and heart work that the full sexual journey requires. More and more of us do not access deep levels of intimacy. More and more of us miss out on deep knowing and being known, loving and being loved, this longing that is wired so into our souls. By normalizing the practice of casual sex, we unwittingly work against our own deep longings. The gift that religion has to bring to the table is the insistence that sexual touch without the requisite psycho-emotional elements in place isn't bad because it breaks some religious commandment. No, it's bad because it shortcuts a process that is essential to sexual well-being. And the heartache that so many people experience as their sexual relationships fracture just keeps rolling along. Families get broken. Hearts get broken. Depression and anxiety continue to rise. More and more children do not have the stability that they need to be prepared for life because their parents do not form stable bonds with one another. And yet we keep advocating a pacing that doesn't give us the time that we need to make our sexual journeys healthy. All right, we'll pick up here in the next episode, and again, I'd love to hear from you. What do you think about these stages? What do you think about this crazy, slow pacing? Let me know.